Bliss said, "Oh, don't discount your boyish ardor. I work wonders." Trevise said impatiently, "Once we get to where we're going, how long will we have to wait for this dome?" "He will be waiting for you. After all, Dome Thrugea has worked for years to bring you here." Trevise stopped in mid-step and looked quickly at Pellerat, who quietly mouthed, "You were right." Bliss, who was looking straight ahead, said calmly,
"I know, Trev, that you have suspected that Gaea was interested in you."
Gaea, said Pellerat softly. She turned to smile at him.
"We have a whole complex of different pronouns to express the shades of individuality that exist on Gaea. I could explain them to you, but till then, Gaea gets across what I mean in a groping sort of way. Please move on, Trev. Dome is waiting, and I don't wish to force your legs to move against your will. It is an uncomfortable feeling if you're not used to it."
Trevise moved on. His glance at Bliss was compounded of the deepest suspicion. 74. Dome was an elderly man. He recited the 253 syllables of his name in a musical flowing of tone and emphasis. "In a way," he said, "it is a brief biography of myself. It tells the hearer, or reader, or censor, who I am, what part I have played in the whole, what I have accomplished. For 50 years and more, however, I have been satisfied to be referred to as Dome. When there are other domes at issue, I can be called Domandio, and in my various professional relationships, other variants are used. Once a Gaean year, on my birthday, my full name is recited in mind as I have just recited it for you in voice. It is very effective, but it is personally embarrassing."
He was tall and thin, almost to the point of emaciation. His deep-set eyes sparkled with anomalous youth, though he moved rather slowly. His jutting nose was thin and long and flared at the nostrils. His hands, prominently veined though they were, showed no signs of arthritic disability. He wore a long robe that was as gray as his hair. It descended to his ankles, and his sandals left his toes bare. Trevise said, "How old are you, sir?"
"Please address me as Dome, Trev. To use other modes of address induces formality and inhibits the free exchange of ideas between you and me. In galactic standard years, I am just past 93. But the real celebration will come not very many months from now, when I reach the 90th anniversary of my birth in Gaean years."
"I would not have guessed you at more than 75, Dome," said Trevise.
"By Gaean standards, I am not remarkable, either in years or in appearance of years, Trev. But come, have we eaten?"
Pellerat looked down at his plate, on which perceptible remnants of a most unremarkable and indifferently prepared meal remained, and said in a diffident manner,
"Dome, may I attempt to ask an embarrassing question? Of course, if it's offensive, you will please say so, and I will withdraw it."
"Go ahead," said Dome, smiling. "I am anxious to explain to you anything about Gaea which arouses your curiosity."
"Why?" said Trevise at once.
"Because you are honored guests. May I have Pell's question?"
Pellerat said,
"Since all things on Gaea share in the group consciousness, how is it that you, one element of the group, can eat this, which was clearly another element?"
"True, but all things recycle. We must eat, and everything we can eat, plant as well as animal, even the inanimate seasonings, are part of Gaea. But then, you see, nothing is killed for pleasure or sport. Nothing is killed with unnecessary pain. And I'm afraid we make no attempt to glorify our meal preparations, for no Gaean would eat except that one must. You did not enjoy this meal, Pell? Trev? Well, meals are not to enjoy. Then, too, what is eaten remains, after all, part of the planetary consciousness. Insofar as portions of it are incorporated into my body, it will participate in a larger share of the total consciousness. When I die, I, too, will be eaten, even if only by decay bacteria, and I will then participate in a far smaller share of the total. But someday, parts of me will be parts of other human beings, parts of many."
Pellerat said, "A sort of transmigration of souls."
"Of what, Pell?"
"I speak of an old myth that is current on some worlds."
"Ah, I don't know of it. You must tell me on some occasion."
Trevise said, "But your individual consciousness, whatever it is about you that is Dome, will never fully reassemble."
"No, of course not. But does that matter? I will still be part of Gaea, and that is what counts. There are mystics among us who wonder if we should take measures to develop group memories of past existences. But the sense of Gaia is that this cannot be done in any practical way and would serve no useful purpose. It would merely blur present consciousness. Of course, as conditions change, the sense of Gaia may change too, but I find no chance of that in the foreseeable future.
Why must you die, Dom? Asked Trevise. Look at you in your 90s. Could not the group consciousness... For the first time, Dom frowned.
Never, he said. I can contribute only so much. Each new individual is a reshuffling of molecules and genes into something new. New talents, new abilities, new contributions to Gaia. We must have them, and the only way we can is to make room. I have done more than most, but even I have my limit, and it is approaching. There is no more desire to live past one's time than to die before it.
And then, as if realizing he had lent a suddenly somber note to the evening, he rose and stretched his arms out to the two.
Come, Trev, Pell, let us move into my studio, where I can show you some of my personal art objects. You won't blame an old man for his little vanities, I hope.
He led the way into another room, where on a small circular table there were a group of smoky lenses connected in pairs.
These, said Dom, are participations I have designed. I am not one of the masters, but I specialize in inanimates, which few of the masters bother with.
Pellaret said, May I pick one up? Are they fragile?
No, no. Bounce them on the floor if you like, or perhaps you had better not. Concussion could dull the sharpness of the vision.
How are they used, Dom?
You put them over your eyes. They'll cling. They do not transmit light. Quite the contrary. They obscure light that might otherwise distract you, though the sensations do reach your brain by way of the optic nerve. Essentially, your consciousness is sharpened and is allowed to participate in other facets of Gaia. In other words, if you look at that wall, you will experience that wall as it appears to itself.
Fascinating, muttered Pellaret. May I try that?
Certainly, Pell. You may take one at random. Each is a different construct that shows the wall, or any other inanimate object you look at, in a different aspect of the object's consciousness.
Pellaret placed one pair over his eyes, and they clung there at once. He started at the touch, and then remained motionless for a long time. Dom said,
When you are through, place your hands on either side of the participation and press them toward each other. It will come right off.
Pellaret did so, blinked his eyes rapidly, then rubbed them. Dom said,
What did you experience?
Pellaret said, It's hard to describe. The wall seemed to twinkle and glisten, and at times it seemed to turn fluid. It seemed to have ribs and changing symmetries. I'm sorry, Dom, but I did not find it attractive.
Dom sighed. You do not participate in Gaia, so you would not see what we see. I had rather feared that. Too bad. I assure you that although these participations are enjoyed primarily for their aesthetic value, they have their practical uses too. A happy wall is a long-lived wall, a practical wall, a useful wall.
A happy wall? Said Trevise, smiling slightly.
Dom said, There is a dim sensation that a wall experiences that is analogous to what happy means to us. A wall is happy when it is well-designed, when it rests firmly on its foundation, when its symmetry balances its parts and produces no unpleasant stresses. Good design can be worked out on the mathematical principles of mechanics, but the use of a proper participation can fine-tune it down to virtually atomic dimensions. No sculptor can possibly produce a first-class work of art here on Gaia without a well-crafted participation, and the ones I produce of this particular type are considered excellent, if I do say so myself. Animate participations, which are not my field, and Dom was going on with the kind of excitement one expects in someone writing his hobby, gives us, by analogy, a direct experience of ecological balance. The ecological balance on Gaia is rather simple, as it is on all worlds, but here at least we have the hope of making it more complex and thus enriching the total consciousness enormously.
Trevise held up his hand in order to forestall Pellaret and wave him into silence. He said, How do you know that a planet can bear a more complex ecological balance if they all have simple ones?
Ah, said Dom, his eyes twinkling shrewdly, You are testing the old man. You know as well as I do that the original home of humanity, Earth, had an enormously complex ecological balance. It is only the secondary worlds, the derived worlds, that are simple.
Pellerat would not be kept silent. But that is the problem I have set myself in life. Why was it only Earth that bore a complex ecology? What distinguished it from other worlds? Why did millions upon millions of other worlds in the galaxy, worlds that were capable of bearing life, develop only an undistinguished vegetation together with small and unintelligent animal life forms?
Dome said, "We have a tale about that, a fable, perhaps. I cannot vouch for its authenticity. In fact, on the face of it, it sounds like fiction."
It was at this point that Bliss, who had not participated in the meal, entered, smiling at Pellerat. She was wearing a silvery blouse, very sheer. Pellerat rose at once.
"I thought you had left us." "Not at all. I had reports to make out, work to do. May I join you now, Dome?"
Dome had also risen, though Trevise remained seated.
"You are entirely welcome, and you ravish these aged eyes."
"It is for your ravishment that I put on this blouse. Pell is above such things, and Trev dislikes them."
Pellerat said, "If you think I am above such things, Bliss, I may surprise you some day."
"What a delightful surprise that would be," Bliss said, and sat down.
The two men did as well.
"Please, don't let me interrupt you."
Dome said, "I was about to tell our guests the story of eternity. To understand it, you must first understand that there are many different universes that can exist, virtually an infinite number. Every single event that takes place can take place or not take place, or can take place in this fashion or in that fashion, and each of an enormous number of alternatives will result in a future course of events that are distinct to at least some degree. Bliss might not have come in just now, or she might have been with us a little earlier or much earlier, or, having come in now, she might have worn a different blouse, or, even in this blouse, she might not have smiled roguishly at elderly men, as is her kind-hearted custom. In each of these alternatives, or in each of a very large number of other alternatives of this one event, the universe would have taken a different track thereafter, and so on, for every other variation of every other event, however minor."
Trevise stirred restlessly. "I believe this is a common speculation in quantum mechanics, a very ancient one, in fact."
"Ah, you've heard of it, but let us go on. Imagine it is possible for human beings to freeze all the infinite number of universes, to step from one to another at will, and to choose which one should be made real, whatever that word means in this connection."
Trevise said, "I hear your words and can even imagine the concept you describe, but I cannot make myself believe that anything like this could ever happen."
"Nor I, on the whole," said Dome, "which is why I say that it would all seem to be a fable. Nevertheless, the fable states that there were those who could step out of time and examine the endless strands of potential reality. These people were called the Eternals, and when they were out of time, they were said to be in eternity. It was their task to choose a reality that would be most suitable to humanity. They modified endlessly, and the story goes into great detail, for I must tell you that it has been written in the form of an epic of inordinate length. Eventually they found, so it is said, a universe in which Earth was the only planet in the entire galaxy on which could be found a complex ecological system, together with the development of an intelligent species capable of working out a high technology. That, they decided, was the situation in which humanity could be most secure. They froze that strand of events as reality, and then ceased operations. Now we live in a galaxy that has been settled by human beings only, and, to a large extent, by the plants, animals, and microscopic life that they carry with them, voluntarily or inadvertently from planet to planet, and which usually overwhelm the indigenous life. Somewhere in the dim mists of probability, there are other realities in which the galaxy is host to many intelligences, but they are unreachable. We, in our reality, are alone. From every action and every event in our reality, there are new branches that set off, with only one in each separate case being a continuation of reality, so that there are vast numbers of potential universes, perhaps an infinite number, stemming from ours. But all of them are presumably alike in containing the one intelligence galaxy in which we live. Or perhaps I should say that all but a vanishingly small percentage are alike in this way, for it is dangerous to rule out anything where the possibilities approach the infinite.
He stopped, shrugged slightly, and added,
"At least that's the story. It dates back to before the founding of Gaia. I don't vouch for its truth."
The three others had listened intently. Bliss nodded her head, as though it were something she had heard before, and she were checking the accuracy of Dome's account. Pellerac reacted with a silent solemnity for the better part of a minute, and then balled his fist and brought it down upon the arm of his chair.
"No," he said in a strangled tone, "that affects nothing. There's no way of demonstrating the truth of the story by observation or by reason, so it can't ever be anything but a piece of speculation. But aside from that, suppose it's true. The universe we live in is still one in which only Earth has developed a rich life and an intelligent species, so that in this universe, whether it is the all-in-all or only one out of an infinite number of possibilities, there must be something unique in the nature of the planet Earth. We should still want to know what that uniqueness is."
In the silence that followed, it was Trevise who finally stirred and shook his head. "No, Janoff," he said, "that's not the way it works. Let us say that the chances are 1 in 1,000,000,000,000, 1 in 10 to the 21st, that out of the billions of habitable planets in the galaxy, only Earth, through the workings of sheer chance, would happen to develop a rich ecology and, eventually, intelligence. If that is so, then 1 in 10 to the 21st of the various strands of potential realities would represent such a galaxy, and the Eternals picked it. We live, therefore, in a universe in which Earth is the only planet to develop a complex ecology, an intelligent species, a high technology, not because there is something special about Earth, but because simply by chance it developed on Earth and nowhere else. I suppose, in fact," Trevise went on thoughtfully, "that there are strands of reality in which only Gaia has developed an intelligent species, or only Seychelles, or only Terminus, or only some planet which in this reality happens to bear no life at all. And all of these very special cases are a vanishingly small percentage of the total number of realities in which there is more than one intelligent species in the galaxy. I suppose that if the Eternals had looked long enough, they would have found a potential strand of reality in which every single habitable planet had developed an intelligent species."
Pellerat said, "Might you not also argue that a reality had been found in which Earth was, for some reason, not as it was in other strands, but specially suited in some way for the development of intelligence? In fact, you can go further and say that a reality had been found in which the whole galaxy was not as it was in other strands, but was somehow in such a state of development that only Earth could produce intelligence."
Trevise said, "You might argue so, but I would suppose that my version makes more sense."
"That's a purely subjective decision, of course," began Pellerat with some heat.
But Dome interrupted, saying, "This is logic chopping. Come, let us not spoil what is proving, at least for me, a pleasant and leisurely evening."
Pellerat endeavored to relax and to allow his heat to drain away. He smiled finally and said,
"As you say, Dome."
Trevise, who had been casting glances at Bliss, who sat with mocking demurity, hands in her lap, now said, "And how did this world come to be, Dome? Gaia, with its group consciousness?" Dome's old head leaned back, and he laughed in a high-pitched manner. His face crinkled as he said,
"Fables again. I think about that sometimes when I read what records we have on human history. No matter how carefully records are kept and filed and computerized, they grow fuzzy with time. Stories grow by accretion. Tales accumulate like dust. The longer the time lapse, the dustier the history, until it degenerates into fables."
Pellerat said, "We historians are familiar with the process, Dome. There is a certain preference for the fable. The falsely dramatic drives out the truly dull, said Liebel Generat about 15 centuries ago. It's called Generat's Law now."
"Is it?" said Dome. "And I thought the notion was a cynical invention of my own. Well, Generat's Law fills our past history with glamour and uncertainty. Do you know what a robot is?"
"We found out on Seychelles," said Trevise dryly.
"You saw one?"
"No. We were asked the question, and when we answered in the negative, it was explained to us."
"I understand. Humanity once lived with robots, you know, but it didn't work well."
"So we were told."
"The robots were deeply indoctrinated with what are called the 3 laws of robotics, which date back into prehistory. There are several versions of what those 3 laws might have been. The orthodox view has the following reading. 1. A robot may not harm a human being, or through inaction allow a human being to come to harm. 2. A robot must obey the orders given it by human beings, except where such orders would conflict with the first law. 3. A robot must protect its own existence as long as such protection does not conflict with the first or second law. As robots grew more intelligent and versatile, they interpreted these laws, especially the all-overriding first, more and more generously, and assumed to a greater and greater degree the role of protector of humanity. The protection stifled people and grew unbearable. The robots were entirely kind. Their labors were clearly humane and were meant entirely for the benefit of all, which somehow made them all the more unbearable. Every robotic advance made the situation worse. Robots were developed with telepathic capacity, but that meant that even human thought could be monitored, so that human behavior became still more dependent on robotic oversight. Again, robots grew steadily more like human beings in appearance, but they were unmistakably robots in behavior, and being humanoid made them more repulsive. So, of course, it had to come to an end.
"Why, of course," asked Pellerat, who had been listening intently.
Dome said, "It's a matter of following the logic to the bitter end. Eventually, the robots grew advanced enough to become just sufficiently human to appreciate why human beings should resent being deprived of everything human in the name of their own good. In the long run, the robots were forced to decide that humanity might be better off caring for themselves, however carelessly and ineffectively. Therefore, it is said, it was the robots who established eternity somehow and became the Eternals. They located a reality in which they felt that human beings could be as secure as possible, alone in the galaxy. Then, having done what they could to guard us, and in order to fulfill the first law in the truest sense, the robots of their own accord ceased to function, and ever since we have been human beings, advancing however we can, alone."
Dom paused. He looked from Trevise to Pellerat and then said,
"Well, do you believe all that?"
Trevise shook his head slowly. "No, there is nothing like this in any historical record I have ever heard of. How about you, Denoff?"
Pellerat said, "There are myths that are similar in some ways."
"Come, Janoff, there are myths that would match anything that any of us can make up, given sufficiently ingenious interpretation. I'm talking about history, reliable records."
"Oh, well, nothing there as far as I know."
Dome said, "I'm not surprised. Before the robots withdrew, many parties of human beings left to colonize robotless worlds in deeper space in order to take their own measures for freedom. They came particularly from overcrowded Earth with its long history of resistance to robots. The new worlds were founded fresh, and they did not even want to remember their bitter humiliation as children under robot nursemaids. They kept no records of it, and they forgot."
Trevise said, "This is unlikely." Pellerat turned to him. "No, Golan, it's not at all unlikely. Societies create their own history and tend to wipe out lowly beginnings, either by forgetting them or inventing totally fictitious heroic rescues. The imperial government made attempts to suppress knowledge of the pre-imperial past in order to strengthen the mystic aura of eternal rule. Then, too, there are almost no records of the days before hyperspatial travel, and you know that the very existence of Earth is unknown to most people today."
Trevise said, "You can't have it both ways, Janoff. If the galaxy has forgotten the robots, how is it that Gaia remembers?"
Bliss intervened with a sudden lilt of soprano laughter.
"We're different."
"Yes," said Trevise. "In what way?"
Dome said, "Now, Bliss, leave this to me. We are different, men of Terminus. Of all the refugee groups fleeing from robotic domination, we who eventually reached Gaia, following in the track of others who reached Seychelles, were the only ones who had learned the craft of telepathy from the robots. It is a craft, you know. It is inherent in the human mind, but it must be developed in a very subtle and difficult manner. It takes many generations to reach its full potential, but once well begun, it feeds on itself. We have been at it for over 20,000 years, and the sense of Gaia is that full potential has even now not been reached. It was long ago that our development of telepathy made us aware of group consciousness, first only of human beings, then animals, then plants, and finally, not many centuries ago, the inanimate structure of the planet itself. Because we traced this back to the robots, we did not forget them. We considered them not our nursemaids, but our teachers. We felt they had opened our mind to something we would never for one moment want them closed to. We remember them with gratitude."
Treviz said, "But just as once you were children to the robots, now you are children to the group consciousness. Have you not lost humanity now as you had then?"
"It is different, Trev. What we do now is our own choice. Our own choice. That is what counts. It is not forced on us from outside, but is developed from the inside. It is something we never forget. And we are different in another way, too. We are unique in the galaxy. There is no world like Gaia."
"How can you be sure?"
"We would know, Trev. We would detect a world consciousness such as ours, even at the other end of the galaxy. We can detect the beginnings of such a consciousness in your second foundation, for instance, though not until 2 centuries ago."
"At the time of the mule?"
"Yes, one of ours."
Dom looked grim.
"He was an aberrant, and he left us. We were naive enough to think that was not possible, so we did not act in time to stop him. Then, when we turned our attention to the outside worlds, we became aware of what you call the second foundation, and we left it to them."
Treviz stared blankly for several moments, then muttered, "There go our history books." He shook his head and said in a louder tone of voice, "That was rather cowardly of Gaia, wasn't it, to do so?" said Treviz. "He was your responsibility."
"You are right. But once we finally turned our eyes upon the galaxy, we saw what until then we had been blind to, so that the tragedy of the mule proved a life-saving matter to us. It was then that we recognized that eventually a dangerous crisis would come upon us. And it has. But not before we were able to take measures, thanks to the incident of the mule."
"What sort of crisis? One that threatens us with destruction?" "I can't believe that. You held off the Empire, the mule, and Seychelles. You have a group consciousness that can pluck a ship out of space at a distance of millions of kilometers. What can you have to fear? Look at Bliss. She doesn't look the least bit perturbed. She doesn't think there's a crisis." Bliss had placed one shapely leg over the arm of the chair and wriggled her toes at him.
"Of course I'm not worried, Trev. You'll handle it."
Trev said forcefully, "Me?"
Dom said, "Gaia has brought you here by means of 100 gentle manipulations. It is you who must face our crisis."
Trev stared at him, and slowly his face turned from stupefaction into gathering rage.
"Me? Why, in all of space, me? I have nothing to do with this." "Nevertheless, Trev," said Dom, with an almost hypnotic calmness, "you, only you, in all of space, only you."
Chapter 18. Collision. 75. Storjendabal was edging toward Gaia almost as cautiously as Treviz had, and now that its star was a perceptible disk and could be viewed only through strong filters, he paused to consider. Suranovi sat to one side, looking up at him now and then in a timorous manner. She said softly,
"Master?"
"What is it, Novi?" he asked abstractedly.
"Are you unhappy?"
He looked up at her quickly.
"No, concerned. Remember that word? I am trying to decide whether to move in quickly or to wait longer. Shall I be very brave, Novi?"
"I think you are very brave all times, Master."
"To be very brave is sometimes to be foolish." Novi smiled.
"How can a master scholar be foolish? That is a son, is it not, Master?"
She pointed to the screen. Jendabal nodded. Novi said, after an irresolute pause,
"Is it the sun that shines on Trantor? Is it the Hamish sun?"
Jendabal said, "No, Novi, it is a far different sun. There are many suns, billions of them."
"Ah, I had known this with my head. I could not make myself believe, however. How is it, Master, that one can know with the head and yet not believe?"
Jendabal smiled faintly. "In your head, Novi," he began, and automatically, as he said that, he found himself in her head.
He stroked it gently, as he always did when he found himself there, just a soothing touch of mental tendrils to keep her calm and untroubled. And he would then have left again, as he always did, had not something drawn him back. What he sensed was indescribable in any but mentalic terms, but, metaphorically, Novi's brain glowed. It was the faintest possible glow. It would not be there, except for the existence of a mentalic field imposed from without, a mentalic field of intensity so small that the finest receiving function of Jendabal's own well-trained mind could just barely detect it, even against the utter smoothness of Novi's mentalic structure.
He said sharply, "Novi, how do you feel?"
Her eyes opened wide.
"I feel well, Master."
"Are you dizzy, confused? Close your eyes and sit absolutely still until I say now."
Obediently, she closed her eyes.
Carefully, Jendebal brushed away all extraneous sensations from her mind, quieted her thought, soothed her emotions, stroked, stroked. He felt nothing but the glow, and it was so faint that he could almost persuade himself it was not there.
"No," he said, and Novi opened her eyes. "How do you feel, Novi?"
"Very calm, master. Rested."
It was clearly too feeble for it to have any noticeable effect on her. He turned to the computer and wrestled with it. He had to admit to himself that he and the computer did not mesh very well together. Perhaps it was because he was too used to using his mind directly to be able to work through an intermediary. But he was looking for a ship, not a mind, and the initial search could be done more efficiently with the help of the computer. And he found the sort of ship he suspected might be present. It was 500,000 kilometers away, and it was much like his own in design, but it was much larger and more elaborate. Once it was located with the computer's help, Jendebal could allow his mind to take over directly. He sent it outward, tight-beamed, and with it felt, or the mentalic equivalent of felt, the ship inside and out. He then sent his mind toward the planet Gaia, approaching it more closely by several millions of kilometers of space, and withdrew. Neither process was sufficient in itself to tell him unmistakably which, if either, was the source of the field. He said,
"Novi, I would like you to sit next to me for what is to follow."
"Master, is there danger?"
"You are not to be in any way concerned, Novi. I will see to it that you are safe and secure."
"Master, I am not concerned that I be safe and secure. If there is danger, I want to be able to help you."
Jendebal softened. He said, "Novi, you have already helped. Because of you, I became aware of a very small thing it was important to be aware of. Without you, I might have blundered rather deeply into a bog, and might have had to pull out only through a great deal of trouble."
"Have I done this with my mind, master, as you once explained?" asked Novi, astonished.
"Quite so, Novi. No instrument could have been more sensitive. My own mind is not. It is too full of complexity." Delight filled Novi's face.
"I am so grateful I can help."
Jendebal smiled and nodded, and then subsided into the somber knowledge that he would need other help as well. Something childish within him objected. The job was his alone. Yet it could not be his alone. The odds were climbing. 76. On Trentor, Quindoshandis felt the responsibility of first speakerhood resting upon him with a suffocating weight. Since Jendebal's ship had vanished into the darkness beyond the atmosphere, he had called no meetings of the table. He had been lost in his own thoughts. Had it been wise to allow Jendebal to go off on his own? Jendebal was brilliant, but not so brilliant that it left no room for overconfidence. Jendebal's great fault was arrogance. Ashandis's own great fault, he thought bitterly, was the weariness of age. Over and over again it occurred to him that the precedent of Preem Palver flitting over the galaxy to set things right was a dangerous one. Could anyone else be a Preem Palver? Even Jendebal. And Palver had had his wife with him. To be sure, Jendebal had this Hamish woman, but she was of no consequence. Palver's wife had been a speaker in her own right. Shandis felt himself aging from day to day as he waited for word from Jendebal. And with each day that word did not come, he felt an increasing tension. It should have been a fleet of ships, a flotilla. No, the table would not have allowed it. And yet, when the call finally came, he was asleep, an exhausted sleep that was bringing him no relief. The night had been windy, and he had had trouble falling asleep to begin with. Like a child, he had imagined voices in the wind. His last thoughts, before falling into an exhausted slumber, had been a wistful building of the fancy of resignation, a wish he could do so, together with the knowledge he could not, for at this moment Delarmy would succeed him. And then the call came, and he sat up in bed, instantly awake.
"You are well?"
he said.
"Perfectly well, First Speaker," said Jendebal. "Should we have visual connection for more condensed communication?"
"Later, perhaps," said Shandis. "First, what is the situation?"
Jendebal spoke carefully, for he sensed the other's recent arousal, and he perceived a deep weariness. He said,
"I am in the neighborhood of an inhabited planet called Gaia, whose existence is not hinted at in any of the galactic records as far as I know."
"The world of those who have been working to perfect the plan? The anti-mules?"
"Possibly, First Speaker. There is the reason to think so. First, the ship bearing Trevise and Pellerat has moved far in toward Gaia and has probably landed there. Second, there is in space about 500,000 kilometers from me a First Foundation warship."
"There cannot be this much interest for no reason."
"First Speaker, this may not be independent interest. I am here only because I am following Trevise, and the warship may be here for the same reason. It remains only to be asked why Trevise is here."
Do you plan to follow him in toward the planet, Speaker?
I had considered that a possibility, but something has come up. I am now 100 million kilometers from Gaia, and I sense in the space about me a mentallic field, a homogeneous one that is excessively faint. I would not have been aware of it at all, but for the focusing effect of the mind of the Hamish woman. It is an unusual mind. I agreed to take her with me for that very purpose.
You are right, then, in supposing it would be so. Did Speaker Delarmy know this, do you think?
When she urged me to take the woman? I scarcely think so, but I gladly took advantage of it, First Speaker.
I am pleased that you did. Is it your opinion, Speaker Jandabal, that the planet is the focus of the field?
To ascertain that, I would have to take measurements at widely spaced points in order to see if there is a general spherical symmetry to the field. My unidirectional mental probe made this seem likely, but not certain. Yet it would not be wise to investigate further in the presence of the first Foundation warship.
Surely it is no threat.
It may be. I cannot as yet be sure that it is not itself the focus of the field, First Speaker.
But they...
First Speaker, with respect, allow me to interrupt. We do not know what technological advances the First Foundation has made. They are acting with a strange self-confidence and may have unpleasant surprises for us. It must be decided whether they have learned to handle mentalics by means of some of their devices. In short, First Speaker, I am facing either a warship of mentalics or a planet of them. If it is the warship, then the mentalics may be far too weak to immobilize me, but they might be enough to slow me, and the purely physical weapons on the warship may then suffice to destroy me. On the other hand, if it is the planet that is the focus, then to have the field detectable at such a distance could mean enormous intensity at the surface, more than even I can handle. In either case, it will be necessary to set up a network, a total network, in which, at need, the full resources of Trantor can be placed at my disposal. The First Speaker hesitated.
A total network? This has never been used, never even suggested, except in the time of the Mule.
This crisis may well be even greater than that of the Mule, First Speaker.
I do not know that the table would agree.
I do not think you should ask them to agree, First Speaker. You should invoke a state of emergency.
What excuse can I give?
Tell them what I have told you, First Speaker.
Speaker Delarmy will say that you are an incompetent coward, driven to madness by your own fears.
Jindabal paused before answering. Then he said, I imagine she will say something like that, First Speaker. But let her say whatever she likes, and I will survive it. What is at stake now is not my pride or self-love, but the actual existence of the Second Foundation. 77. Arla Brano smiled grimly, her lined face setting more deeply into its fleshy crags. She said, I think we can push on with it. I'm ready for them. Cadell said, Do you still feel sure you know what you're doing? If I were as mad as you pretend you think I am, Leono, would you have insisted on remaining on this ship with me? Cadell shrugged and said, Probably. I would then be here on the off chance, Madam Mayor, that I might stop you, divert you, at least slow you before you went too far. And, of course, if you're not mad...
Yes?
Why, then, I wouldn't want to have the histories of the future give you all the mention. Let them state that I was here with you and wonder, perhaps, to whom the credit really belongs, eh, Mayor?
Clever, Leono, clever, but quite futile. I was the power behind the throne through too many mayoralties for anyone to believe I would permit such a phenomenon in my own administration.
We shall see.
No, we won't, for such historical judgments will come after we are dead. However, I have no fears, not about my place in history, and not about that.
And she pointed to the screen. Compor's ship, said Cadell.
Compor's ship, true, said Brano, but without Compor aboard. One of our scout ships observed the changeover. Compor's ship was stopped by another. Two people from the other ship boarded that one, and Compor later moved off and entered the other.
Brano rubbed her hands.
Trevise fulfilled his role perfectly. I cast him out into space in order that he might serve as lightning rod, and so he did. He drew the lightning. The ship that stopped Compor was Second Foundation.
How can you be sure of that, I wonder, said Cadell, taking out his pipe and slowly beginning to pack it with tobacco.
Because I always wondered if Compor might not be under Second Foundation control. His life was too smooth. Things always broke right for him, and he was such an expert at hyperspatial tracking. His betrayal of Trevise might easily have been the simple politics of an ambitious man, but he did it with such unnecessary thoroughness, as though there were more than personal ambition to it.
All guesswork, Mayor.
The guesswork stopped when he followed Trevise through multiple jumps as easily as if there had been but one.
He had the computer to help, Mayor.
But Brano leaned her head back and laughed. My dear Leono, you are so busy devising intricate plots that you forget the efficacy of simple procedures. I sent Compor to follow Trevise, not because I needed to have Trevise followed. What need was there for that? Trevise, however much he might want to keep his movement secret, could not help but call attention to himself in any non-Foundation world he visited. His advanced Foundation vessel, his strong Terminus accent, his Foundation credits, would automatically surround him with a glow of notoriety. And in case of any emergency, he would automatically turn to Foundation officials for help, as he did on Seychelles, where we knew all that he did as soon as he did it, and quite independently of Compor. No, she went on thoughtfully, Compor was sent out to test Compor, and that succeeded, for we gave him a defective computer quite deliberately. Not one that was defective enough to make the ship unmaneuverable, but certainly one that was insufficiently agile to aid him in following a multiple jump. Yet Compor managed that without trouble.
I see there's a great deal you don't tell me, Mayor, until you decide you ought to.
I only keep these matters from you, Leono, that it will not hurt you not to know. I admire you, and I use you, but there are sharp limits to my trust, as there is in yours for me, and please don't bother to deny it.
I won't, said Caudle dryly. And some day, Mayor, I will take the liberty of reminding you of that. Meanwhile, is there anything else that I ought to know now? What is the nature of the ship that stopped them? Surely, if Compor is second Foundation, so is that ship.
It is always a pleasure to speak to you, Leono. You see things quickly. The second Foundation, you see, doesn't bother to hide its tracks. It has defenses that it relies on to make those tracks invisible, even when they are not. It would never occur to a second Foundationer to use a ship of alien manufacture, even if they knew how neatly we could identify the origin of a ship from the pattern of its energy use. They could always remove that knowledge from any mind that had gained it, so why bother taking the trouble to hide? Well, our scout ship was able to determine the origin of the ship that approached Compor within minutes of sighting it.
And now the second Foundation will wipe that knowledge from our minds, I suppose.
If they can, said Brano, but they may find that things have changed.
Caudle said, Earlier, you said you knew where the second Foundation was. You would take care of Gaia first, then Trantor. I deduce from this that the other ship was of Trantorian origin.
You suppose correctly. Are you surprised?
Caudle shook his head slowly. Not in hindsight. Ebling Miss, Torren Dorel, and Beta Dorel were all on Trantor during the period when the mule was stopped. Arcade Dorel, Beta's granddaughter, was born on Trantor. And it was on Trantor again when the Second Foundation was itself supposedly stopped. In her account of events, there is a Preem Palver who played a key role, appearing at convenient times, and he was a Trantorian traitor. I should think it was obvious that the Second Foundation was on Trantor, where, incidentally, Harry Seldon himself lived at the time he founded both Foundations.
Quite obvious, except that no one ever suggested the possibility. The Second Foundation saw to that. It is what I meant when I said they didn't have to cover their tracks when they could so easily arrange to have no one look in the direction of those tracks or wipe out the memory of those tracks after they had been seen.
Caudle said, In that case, let us not look too quickly in the direction in which they may simply be wanting us to look. How is it, do you suppose, that Trevise was able to decide the Second Foundation existed? Why didn't the Second Foundation stop him?
Brano held up her gnarled fingers and counted on them. First, Trevise is a very unusual man, who, for all his obstreperous inability to use caution, has something about him that I have not been able to penetrate. He may be a special case.